Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Recording has begun.
Hey. Hello, and welcome to episode 39 of Bilge Pumps. Yes, we are due our midlife crisis. We're probably having it, but we don't realise it. This week, we are joined by two superstar engineers. We have Steve George, a well-known friend of the Bilge Pumps crew, who comes in and basically tells us all about the very scary things of engineering he knows and the very scary things of engineering he's done, including repairing a helicopter while sea darts were going off behind him, which is an incident I think none of us will ever forget hearing the retelling about, because he was quite so calm about what is, frankly, a very scary experience. And Salvatore Michelangelo, sometimes he markets himself as the other Sal, but is, I can be assured, because I do sometimes get contacted by his students, one of the best engineers going and one of the best professors. And of course, we've got both both Drac and Hello. Jamie from Armored Carriers. Now, our usual Jamie, this week I will apologize for last time. This time I have poor Steve and Sal have experienced the full benefit, the full experience of the sheer quantity of timing emails I have sent out to ensure it is the correct time.
Google Calendars helps.
So we've gathered all today to discuss the rating system which Bilge Pumps is starting to put together, because both Sal and Steve have some very good ideas and to make it better, primarily. And the thing is, we think this is a good thing we're keeping going, mainly because of the furor it's causing. And rather like Peeps, who when he came up with his rating system, it was mainly for, well, basically explaining it to less informed politicians, occasionally even that less informed politician known as the King, exactly why he needed to build certain ships and about building a balanced force. Now, considering the amount of efforts we've had over recent years to try and get a high-low mix, so you can have numbers as well as quality into Western navies, it seems to Bilge Pumps crew rather than a good idea to maybe go back to the last time there was an actual naval administration successful in getting a high-low mix, and look at how they did it. And how they did it was by a very easy system to quantify their ships. So we've nicked that system, basically. We have nicked the rating system. And I'm going to hand over to Drac, because he is in the process of writing the first draft of what will eventually come out as a document, which we will hope to publish on SimSec.
Yeah.
Giving full written details of what our proposal of a rating system is.
So I'll skim through, because I'm currently up to 5.5 pages, which will take forever and a day to read out. But fortunately, 2 pages, that is tabling. So yes, as Dr. Clark mentioned, when the what was called the establishment was brought in, and there were various establishments through the 1700s, before that you had all sorts of weird and wonderful ways of referring to ships. So you could have royal ship, great ship, frigate, great frigate, second rank ship, first rank ship. Obviously galleon was still around, but none of those really related to each other. So a great frigate could be bigger or smaller than a great ship, or bigger or smaller than a royal ship. And sometimes ships had different designations, because HMS Sovereign of the Seas, for example, was simultaneously a great ship, a royal ship, and a great frigate, which didn't help anyone.
It sounds quite familiar. What is actually a destroyer these days, by the way?
Well, this is the thing. So standardize everything. And admittedly, some of the standardization in the establishments didn't work so well, because they also tried to standardize weights and displacements as well as armament. And the fixed weight and displacement aspect didn't really pan out very well. But the rating via guns did stick around pretty much to the end of the age of sail. And from that, you had first, second, third and fourth rates, which were your ships of the line, your front line warships that would stand against the enemy. Although towards the end, the fourth rate was being removed from that role. And then you have the frigates, which were the fifth and sixth rates. So those were ships that were, they could do everything. They could be scouts, commerce raiders, convoy escorts, general purpose ships, but they could also still be there at battles, albeit in a peripheral role. and anything that was less than the sixth rate was unrated. They were armed, they had use, but you would never take them into a frontline engagement if you could possibly help it.
So, like, kind of like the modern Belgian Navy designs.
Yeah. So, bearing in mind that,
you're determined to start another cross-channel spat, aren't you?
Belgium is
They're
a place for European nations.
I'm not afraid.
Yeah. Well, Belgium is a place for European nations to resolve all their differences. So that's why it was created. But yeah, so I think the reason this has grown out is that the current system of classifying vessels is incredibly broad, and it's very easy to misunderstand or misinterpret what it means, because we're essentially left with a rump of what was the World War II period classification. Because in World War II, you had aircraft carriers, battleships, battle cruisers, heavy cruisers, light cruisers, destroyers, destroyer escorts or frigates, sloops and corvettes. And then occasionally you'd get a weird one like the Alaska-class supercruiser. But now, and apart from the occasional reference to the Kirovs as battle cruisers and the Tychos as cruisers, literally every other major surface combatant or ocean-going surface combatant that anyone possesses is either called destroyer or frigate. And that really begins to fall apart on close examination, because there's this general rule of thumb that destroyers deal with anti-aircraft warfare, frigates deal with anti-sub warfare, but you now are getting anti-aircraft warfare frigates and anti-submarine destroyers, which throws that out. And then you have the other issue, which is that there are some destroyers in service that are 2.5 times the displacement, 3 times the armament of some of the smallest destroyers in service. And some of the frigates in service are actually displacing more than most of the destroyers, and in some cases even carrying a significantly better anti-aircraft suite than small destroyers do. So,
despite the fact they're supposed to be anti-submarine warfare frigates.
So if you say this is a destroyer or this is a frigate, it's essentially meaningless nowadays. It basically just means it's an ocean-going surface combatant of some description. So the system...
I think it's a marketing term. I think you pitch frigate as a lobbyist to the ears of those who have the public purse as being the cheaper, more sensible option, and destroyer as being the more fashionable prestige object.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's if you when it comes to actual combat effectiveness, you could show up with a bunch of, say, NATO ships, trying to organize them into some kind of defensive screen, and if you look at your list of ships, you've got, say, a Horizon class destroyer, maybe one of the French ones, and you've also got an Arleigh Burke, and ostensibly they are both anti-aircraft warfare destroyers, but only an idiot would think that they are in any way comparable as anti-aircraft warfare vessels. And then simultaneously you've got some frigates that, as they closely approach or in some cases even surpass some of the small destroyers. So it's not an easy thing to work out just from those designations. So the basic system that I've devised to try and classify things, taking from the Age of Sail, is to go, okay, in the Age of Sail, ships were rated by the number of guns they were pierced with, and those were your long guns. So it could be a 12 pounder on a sixth rate, up to a 32, 36, 42 pounder on a first rate, but they are your fixed guns. They didn't have the very tiny chase guns, the carronades or swivel guns, etc. Those weren't counted. So using a similar idea, I've said, right, well, we'll count VLS cells and any dedicated launch systems for long range offensive weapons like Harpoon or LBRASM or Sunburn or Granite, and we'll ignore anything that is basically a point defense system that only really serves to try and keep the warship alive at the last minute. So short range missiles like CRAM or TOR on the Russian ships, and also not including torpedo launchers, deck guns or helicopters. Because whilst there is a certain amount of argument to be made that, yes, you can obviously use your 5-inch or 4.5-inch deck gun in a surface engagement, or you can load a couple of missiles up on your helicopter and send them out, to be perfectly honest. If you're that will work if you're fighting someone that you could beat anyway, but if you're fighting a peer opponent, if you're down to let's use our deck gun in a surface fight against a peer navy, or we're sending out an SH-60 or a Merlin with a Sea Eagle or a harpoon strapped to the side, something's gone horribly wrong. And in any case, you've only got one or two helicopters, one or two deck guns, so it's not going to make a massive difference to the number of overall weapon systems anyway. So using that classification system, I've then graduated all the various... I've taken the biggest navies that are around at the moment. So we've got the US Navy, obviously, the Chinese Navy, Russian Navy, British Navy, Japanese and South Korean navies, and I threw the French in there as well.
Belgians?
Well, they are a little bit ditchy. But
what about the Italian Navy? I think I'm wondering if they should be in there, because the Italian
problem is
the
they
Danish
use
Navy.
The Horizons and Friends, yeah. And so do the French, so it would just be double counting. But so I came up with a list that splits everything into first, second, third and fourth rates, which are your kind of your ships of the line, the ships that you should be putting in harm's way in a surface or anti-air engagement. And then you've got the rated ships not of the line, so fifth and sixth rate. So they're ships that you'd still have in your battle group, you still want there, but you're going to have them as peripheral or second line ships in a surface or air engagement. And then you've got your unrated ships, which are why are you even bringing this to a fight? And
so
obviously when you consider
where does the Belgian Navy fit again?
Well, with eight cells, that counts as an unrated ship, so that's in the level of sloop or gun brig. But obviously
before anyone complains, you can't bully a whole nation. I'm trying, but you can't.
Probably try Liechtenstein. There's few enough of them. But
oh, I like Liechtenstein. They're nice people.
There's a separate table I've drawn up, which we can maybe talk about later, for aircraft carriers, where I've included strike aircraft and AEW, because those are your strike force and strike force multipliers. I haven't done the subsurface one yet, but that's going to be a lot more complicated. But just to give some idea, to start our discussion, what I've rated as the first-rate ships of the line, i.e. under the sort of mid-17th century establishments, a ship of 100 guns or more, you have five entries there. You have the Ticonderogas, the Kirovs, the Type 055s, the Myers, and the Sejong the Greats. Then at the second rate, which is ships of 90 to 98 guns, you have the Arleigh Burke and the Zumwalt. At the third rate, which is 70 to 88 guns, you have the Slaber, the Yisun Shin, and in theory, the Type 45, if anyone could be bothered to pay for those 16 additional VLS cells. Then at the fourth rate, so these are your 50 to 68 gun ships. So this is kind of like Nelson's Agamemnon type of scale. There you've got the actual Type 45s as they stand now, the Type 052Ds, the Type 052Cs, the Horizon in its various configurations, and one quick entry into a ship of the line, which is the Gorshkovs, because they just seem to be carrying stupid amounts of surface-to-surface missiles. And then in your fifth-rate category, so these are your heavy frigates, you've got Constellation leading the pack by a significant distance. Then Type 23, Type 26, Hunter, Type 054A, the Frem AAW variant, and the Asahi from the Japanese. The sixth rates are the Type 31s, the Frems in their ASW configuration, and the new Japanese frigate 30FF, which will probably become Kamano class. And then in the Hall of Shame, the unrated ships, you've got the two LCS, assuming they don't get the surface warfare module upgrade. The Eudaloy, amusingly enough, because it has eight Silex missiles and that's it. Everything else is point defense. And the French Lafayette, which is ostensibly a frigate with basically almost no actual offensive power. So I'm not entirely sure what they were thinking there. But that's my rating system for surface and anti-air combatants. And I will shut up now because you've heard enough of me. So what do we think?
Well, I've been interjecting all the way. So, Sal, Steve, which one of you would like to go first? I know Sal has ideas about how he'd like to change things, and I'm sure Steve does.
I'll sit here and wait.
Well, as I talked about with my idea that I floated with you gentlemen, first of all, I love the idea. I listened to it more and more. At first, I thought it was literally crazy. I was like, okay, this is them having a good time and just enjoying it. But then the more you think about it and the more you put it into context, I think one of the things that I think is the best thing about the system is it does explain to those who don't know classification of vessels a very quick measurement of where they stand. Because I think you're right. I think Jamie's exactly right that politicians sell vessels based on their name in some ways. We need these destroyers, but we're going to build a frigate instead. And frigates are much cheaper than destroyers, even though they're really not. And I think we get lost in that classification system. The issue I have with the system, and this is where I mentioned it to you all, is when they made the rating system, it was obviously one-dimensional. It was anti-surface. That's all they were dealing with. They were only dealing with anti-surface. There was no anti-aircraft unless you had a balloon flying over, or there's no anti-submarine unless somebody's cranking the turtle up against a ship of the line. And I was thinking about, you know, how do you quantify this? Because, again, you can load vessels with different loadouts. In the Persian Gulf War in 1990, the Navy loaded two Spruance 61-cell destroyers with nothing but Tomahawks for a pure land attack mission. They had almost no anti-aircraft capability at all. If you look at some of the vessels, like the Ticonderogas, for example, Ticonderogas versus an older class cruiser, if you go back in the U.S. Navy to the Leahys or the Belknaps, for example, you'd rate a Belknap or a Leahy probably around a third class, maybe, you know, with about 60-something missiles on board. But they can only control about four missiles at a time, unlike the Ticonderogas with the spy system that allows them in the Aegis that allowed them to track multiple targets, which I think is, again, it gets into the weeds here a bit. And I think that's one of the things I like about your system is it's not designed to get into the weeds. What I talked about was an idea of rating them by classes. Go back to the first, second, third class system, but you rate based on capabilities. You know, you could have a vessel that's a first-class anti-submarine warfare vessel. It's designed to do ASW. It's got ASROC. It's got a multifunction helicopter bay, which can fly off a lot of vessels. It's got towed array. It's got a passive sonar suite. But at the same time, it may be a third-class anti-surface warfare vessel. It doesn't quite have the capability to strike out. It gets a little more complicated, obviously, because you're looking at different capabilities where you may have a vessel that's a first-class AAW, second-class ASW, and third-class anti-strike. But I also think you get into that qualifications. But I think for the, you know, for a basic system, I think the rating system that you've all designed is a perfect measurement. I think it does allow you to very quickly measure them because, again, we're running around with 9,000-ton frigates out there that's the size of a World War II light cruiser, and it throws the measurements off completely. I mean, no one has a cruiser yet. You could make the argument a batch of people actually do have cruisers based on the old-term measurements.
And the old 14,000-ton destroyer in Zumwalt, in the Zumwalt, and if you think about that, in World War II, destroyers were supposed to be less than 2,000 tons. So that's seven destroyers. That's darn near a whole flotilla of destroyers. That's not one destroyer. That's a flotilla of destroyers in one hull.
You're exactly right. And I think, again, that's where the measurement comes off. And that's why I think the rating system you're all designing is a good one to have. Because, again, for, you know, I just finished reading Jerry Hendrick's new book on the Navy. Very brief, short little book. It was designed not so much for naval professionals, but for people to pick up very quickly and read and get a quick measurement. The problem with navies today, it's very complicated. It's very hard to sell that, especially to politicians. So I think your system does a good job with that. I'll pass it over to Steve and let Steve comment on it.
I speaking as a systems guy, I can see the attractiveness of a simple rating system based on what seems to be the amount of high explosive you can direct at a target. I think the thing that should be considered, especially these days, is the sensors. Because, frankly, as the Russians showed, you can have tons and tons and tons of weapons, but if your radars and your fire control aren't up to snuff, you're just carrying dead weight. As far as aircraft carriers go, which would be more my area of expertise, I think there you've got to be looking at sortie rate and probably range. Because really and truly, that's the basic output of a carrier, is either strike or air dominance capability at range.
That's a good point. Yeah, because I suppose that it does make it slightly harder to quantify, because then you've got to actually find out figures for how quickly can they sortie aircraft, and the range figures are slightly easier to figure out.
Well, there's actually quite a bit out there that you can do for instance, if you look at the F-35, they actually had KPPs for sortie rates, so you can at least see what they were trying to get to. And you can make some pretty good estimates for cannon trap based really on the size of the deck, number of catapults, and the number of aircraft that they carry. It is a bit more complicated now than simply, well, we're going to lay two ships next to each other, and the one that has 100 guns is going to beat the ones with 60 guns. It's the thing I learned at the rear end of my time in the service was that the capability, for instance, if we take this to the platforms I know about, the Sea Harrier FA-2 was fully capable of destroying any F-15 that got anywhere near it. But if you took the basic number of missiles and the size of the aircraft and its G and its endurance, it should have been toast. And if you'd applied a rating system where you awarded the F-15 high marks for carrying 6 AIM 7s and 4 AIM 9s, that wasn't really reflected what was actually achievable.
I think Steve makes a good point on that, because that was the selling point of the Ford class carrier. Even though the Ford gets a lot of problems associated with it, if you look at it compared to a Nimitz in terms of its sortie rate, its ability to deploy, it's demonstrably different. I mean, that was when the elevators are working and everything's working just right, in a perfect situation, that was one of the big selling points. I think the other thing too, and bringing this up, is what happens if I take an offshore supply vessel and I stick a 41 cell VLS on it? Am I now within the rating system? Because I don't have the technology on board to direct it, but if I put a Link 11, Link 14 system on it and I link it to a vessel, does that make me now a warship? I think on the flip side of that, what it does do is it turns that ship that's linked to it into a much bigger vessel. If you have, your 16 cell, vessel out there, but you're able to link up to 3 or 4 offshore vehicles that have VLS cells on it, all of a sudden now you go from being a 6th rate now to a 3rd rate, for example, because you have this capability to do it, and you have ability to spread out more. Again, I think this demonstrates one of those systems. This is the problem that the U.S. Navy has in selling unmanned systems to the Congress. They just don't want to buy into it because they don't understand how that system will magnify the capabilities of the U.S. Navy. But if you can sit there and demonstrate that you can make any vessel now larger. And also, you solve that resupply problem, because you're not going to solve VLS resupply as long as you're going up and down into a cell. You're not going to be able to resupply at sea into a VLS. I mean, I've resupplied VLSs at the dock, and we've had to stop the reloading because a ship's passing by, and you get just enough a little sway at the dock that it stops you from loading a VLS cell.
So I have to say that's the other thing that's caused quite a bit of a furor. The fact that we pointed out that the big advantage of an aircraft carrier is you can resupply it at sea, which yes. You can't do with an escort. And the amount of people who've been written in and gone various things of, but escorts are cheaper than carriers. And you go, well, yes, but if you're going to reload one, you're pretty much bringing it home and reloading it. You're not doing it at sea with the VLS. So you can restock with fuel, food, most of the light caliber weapon ammunition. Fine. But you can't do the missiles.
Well, you could certainly restock with SIGDAR.
That was one of the other discussions we were having last week, which was whether or not the... Now, there's perhaps, with modern technology, there's an argument to be made for going back to swing arm launchers, because the VLS, as we covered last week, the VLS system's main advantage over the swing arm launchers in the 80s and 90s was rate of fire. But if modern technology can make a swing arm launcher fit that feeds off of a magazine have a similar or possibly even better rate of fire than kind of the one missile per second you can get out of a VLS, then if you go back to your swing-arm launcher with magazine, then not only is the other sort of the missiles themselves potentially stored somewhere that's slightly safer than right up there on deck, but also it then becomes possible to reload at sea, because you're not having to try and slot a VLS VLS box into its cell. You can, like they do with battleship shells, you can just crane them onto the deck and feed them in a system kind of like how they feed torpedoes into a sub. It doesn't have to be absolutely precise, because the precision comes when it reaches down into the magazines, and then you can have internal mechanisms within the ship that will precisely align it in its magazine rack.
The big fear was, you know, in the 80s was the backfires coming, you know, through the GIUK gap and just smothering convoys and the carrier battle groups. And they needed to get, you know, standards up as fast as they could. And that was the real big push to VLS, especially with the Spy One, the GIA system, now that you can track them and everything. But I do think there is a utility to the swing arm, because, as you said, you can load them. You can, you know, you can basically have a magazine like you did once before and be able to select. And it may be involved, you know, almost like a Long Beach class cruiser, where you stack the Terriers, you know, with a couple of swing arms, almost like turrets, you know, and go with it. Sorry, Steve, I cut you off. I apologize.
I was just going to say that it brings us back to the point where why we started to discuss this entirely in the first place, which is warships in an area denial environment. Like the Falklands, you need ships that can occupy a space. They need to be able to not just get halfway to their objective, defend the assault ships from one wave of incoming long-range missiles, and to have the convoy turn around and go back home. You're going to have to cover that group of ships all the way to the target, which will potentially, in an area denial environment, mean that you're facing multiple waves of land-based, air-delivered, ship-delivered, submarine-delivered, you know, projectiles. And when you're looking at so many of the modern warships carrying around 20, 30 missiles, and you're probably going to have two or three of those ships in a task force, that's barely enough to counteract, you know, one strike from a group of H6Ks. So that's what prompted this whole discussion in the first place. VLS does not seem to be the right system for area denial, as it was for the Reforger concept in the 70s and 80s. That's at least my surface thinking. You guys have naturally thought about these things a hell of a lot deeper than I have.
Well, I mean, one of the big things about the VLS systems is that they're far more efficient on space. The C-Dart had a monstrous impact on the bow section of the Invincibles. I mean, one of the reasons we were short on space down in the hangar was we had to lose 40 or 50 feet of foreign space for the absolutely ginagorous C-Dart system.
Mm.
The other thing is that the modern missiles out of the VLS systems exploit vertical launch to achieve a very rapid ability to engage targets by vertical launch. Then they tip and they tip over it and engage. I think that if you've raised a very important point there, where you need to decouple the rating system from the scenario, because you can invent any scenario that would adjust that. I mean, picking up on the armoured carriers, one thing I've learned really in the last few years is the very large impact of the Royal Navy's aircraft direction systems on the way they employ the carriers, for good and bad, and their ability to punch way above their weight. I mean, when you look back at the early convoys in the Med, I think what the Fleet Arm achieved with Fulmers is astonishing. But that's where I think I come back to the system of systems approach, which I know is more complicated, but I think it could more accurately reflect actually what the platform can do.
Yeah.
Speaking as a survivor of the days when the Invincibles were called a through deck cruiser, I absolutely understand the way in which the terminology of these ships has been systematically abused. Actually, wasn't it the United States who built a frigate? Was it the Truxton or the Bainbridge?
Yeah.
Nope, you're right.
Yeah. Wasn't that something like a 10,000 ton frigate?
Nuclear powered. A nuclear powered frigate.
So, I think having a rating system is a really good idea. I think you've got to make it simple enough, but I think you've got to put enough into it that you're actually reflecting the combat value of that. Because where in this system would you put an aircraft carrier?
Yeah.
Well, are they going to be automatically first rate if they've got cat and traps?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Alex has actually worked on a sort of adaptation of two aircraft carriers. And go on, Alex, read out
what I was going to say just before that was, in regards to Steve's comments about systems and such, like, I think that is a very valid point. But I also think actually there's kind of a loose analogy in the Age of Sail that you can run with, both in terms of the capabilities of the weapons and the capabilities of the sensors and other systems, because you might have, say, a 32-gun frigate, a small fifth rate. But if you said to someone at the time, this is a 32-gun fifth rate, no one in their right mind would assume that three 32-gunners, therefore theoretically having 96 guns, could go toe-to-toe with a second or first rate, because they understood that the fifth rate would have the 12-pounder or the 18-pounder, and the ship of the line would be 24s and 32s.
but that's an implicit understanding that that underpins it, and it's in a similar way when you're looking at the surface combatants. You have to have this implicit understanding that yes, just because the Type 23 has theoretically is a 40 gunner, that doesn't mean that two Type 23s are superior in air-to-air warfare than a fully upgraded Type 45, because the Sea Scepter is not as capable as Sea Viper. And the same thing, Constellations, like two Constellations aren't going to match a Burke, because the Burke can go all singing, all dancing with Aegis and SM6, whereas the Constellation's very unlikely to be doing that. So there's that aspect. And then when it comes to the sensors, that I think that it is a little bit of a difficult one, because you can build the ship, and the ship can carry so many weapons, but the sensors you can change, and to an extent the weapons you can change as well. It's like it's barely the first Burks coming in with mid-range SM2s, and now theoretically can have SM6s. It's the same ship, the same VLS cells, but completely different levels of lethality.
Or SM3 ABMs, which are a completely different generator thing again.
And the same thing with radars and other sensors. But I think in those terms, again, kind of the loose analogy for the Age of Sail type rating system would be, it would require a certain level of understanding of where the technical capability of the Navy that you're talking about sits. Because if you said, say, Napoleonic Wars, you said, right, well, here's a 74-gunner third-rate ship of the line for the Royal Navy, and here's an 80-gunner third-rate ship of the line for the French Navy, on paper, kind of like the F-15C Harrier equation, on paper, 80 guns is better than 74. But anyone with a relatively decent understanding of the period would understand that, generally speaking, the French crew's not going to be able to fire anywhere near as fast as the Royal Navy crew. So actually, that 74 is actually a much superior combatant to the 80 because of the quality of its crew.
And you've got copper bottering as well, whereas the Royal Navy had copper bottering. It was still a third rate, but it had a copper bottom, so it would tend to work longer at better rate, sort of further from home, and be quite easier to keep clean. And that was really high tech for the time, the French one didn't. But they were still considered third rates.
So it requires an understanding of the technical capabilities of the nations, and obviously an honest one as well, not just assuming that because they're not on our side, they must be worse.
I hesitate to do this because I know it's a thing that happens online, but I'm going to mention the word the Nazis. You look at the German tank development in World War II, tanks are something I take a bit of an interest in, because I once did guns, and once you start to talk guns, you get these amazing guns. But I learned that the tank is a very difficult design problem. And a simple way to express it is triangle. And one side of the triangle is firepower, the second is protection, and the third is mobility. And the Nazis seem to have succumbed to a rating system that prioritized nothing but firepower and protection. And then they spent a large portion of their scarce resources building heavier and more monstrous and immobile tanks. And yet, in the world of tank top trumps, if you asked what was the best tank of World War II, no doubt it's the King Tiger or the Mouse or whatever the 1,000-ton fantasy. So perhaps in looking at this rating system, if one restricts oneself to a triangle of caliber of firepower or the range, the amount of it you've got, and the sensors that you've got to actually make it hit, could that be an approach?
You might be able to mix. You might be able to mix the two, like a first class, and then a three designation character, which gives you the quality of those different levels. So
Steve,
I think that's where I came in with the class system was trying to factor in some of those tangible elements into the rating system, because I think Steve makes a good point, you know, because I forget who did. I think it was Alex mentioned it at one point, talking about how the third class was really the most common vessel in the Age of Sail. Yeah. And, you know, and in truth, that's the vessel you want more than anything else. You don't need the first and second classes. You need them back. You know, again, I think one of the biggest issues we have in the U.S. Navy right now is the concept of sending a Burke destroyer, you know, that's, you know, anti-ballistic missile defense through the Taiwan Strait just for a show of force, when all you need is a six rate to do that, just to show the American flag. You don't, you know, because we don't have OPVs. We just don't. So, yeah. You know, we have to send, a fairly top line vessel to go do something that's fairly routine. And then we wear those vessels out and they're susceptible to the collisions that we saw in 2017 because they just get overworked.
But to be fair, the Royal Navy is building an entire class, the Type 31s, just for those sort of missions.
Right.
That's basically the Royal Navy's gone, we are only going to get a certain number of ships. We can keep wearing out our top of the line ships, which are fourth rates. Mm. I think both the Type 26 and Type 45s fit in the fourth rate category, don't they? Just about.
Hang on.
They've built the Type 31s literally for the purpose of just going, right, and you're going to be forward-based, you're going to be doing the Strait of Hormuz, you're going to be doing probably the Singapore Straits and the Straits of Formosa and all these sort of things when we need you to go there, Taiwan Straits. Because you need to have a presence, you do need to have a ship turn up. But also there's the advantage that if you turn up with your top-of-the-line ship, you're basically saying, we consider this a very high threat and you a very scary enemy, so we're turning up with our best. Whereas if you turn up with, this is our Type 31. It can take care of itself, but it's not really anything fantastic. We see what you're doing. We're here. Just stop it. You're boring us now. Yeah. If we have to call one of the big boys, we will. But really, no, just stop doing that. Go and have some chocolate. Go
get back to the primary motivation of all of this, which is to stop politicians buying a Belgian frigate.
Yes.
You guys have got
something. It's not a frigate. It's unrated.
Yeah,
I
don't know if you've seen that design, Steve, but basically they took a design that the Dutch are using, which has 16 VLS cells, and then for reasons known best only to the Dark Powers, they just went, yes, we will have that, but we will only fit 8 VLS cells, but we're not going to use the space for the other 8 for anything. We're just going to put a blank plate over it and just have half as many missiles, because then it's cheaper.
And they are mounted. They're not mounted crosswise on the ship. They are mounted lengthwise, the cells. Yeah. So it's got literally, I think on the starboard side, it's got a block of 8 cells, and on the port side, it's got a steel plate.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and just speaking as a person who went down south in a ship that was deliberately limited to carry only 8 Sea Kings. And we ended up with 22 aircraft on board, but no fresh water. And so we had these rather amusing squadron instructions on how to shower on alternate days of the week. By drawing a line around your body with a black pen, and you did the top half on the even days, the bottom half on odd days, and you used your flannel for the little bits on Sundays. but the point is that you've got to have a rating system that I think is as independent of the scenario as you can. Because once you stir that one in, then you can really justify anything. But I think as a basis, I think the way you're going is extremely good. For the aircraft carrier, of course, the performance of the aircraft has to be included. Because if you look, for instance, at the Royal Navy in 1939 and 40, the Art Royal and the incoming illustrious class were extremely good ships. The aircraft were pants.
Yeah, and that sounds like my PhD thesis. Basically, it's a case of Royal Navy, naval aviation in 1930s. Well, the aircraft carriers they developed were the best in the world. The aircraft they were putting on them were developed by the Air Ministry. There was a small problem here.
Well, yes and no. And I think there's a point to make is that just like ships, the fleet air arm particularly fell victim to a huge rate of technical change that occurred in the period 1935 to 1939.
And I mean, if you look at the coming, it were all due to come in 1940 to 41, and they get cancelled because of the Battle of Britain, basically, or deferred because of the Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the cycle issue.
Yeah. But you can certainly take the leading particulars, the core characteristics in the case of the tank, mobility, firepower, protection. Select, I would suggest, no more than three, and then see how your rating would.
But, and I think that could give you a class rating, Steve, like what we're talking about, where you can basically evaluate that. I think the rating system goes in. I really wanted to ask Drac, how does he factor in? Because one of the things I think the rating system does very well is a ship like the Ohio SSGN, which comes in as a first rate. It should come in first rate at that. And with its stealth technology, ability to submerge, doesn't have to worry about anti-surface, doesn't have to worry about anti-aircraft. I think it highlights to, you know, again, politicians, the role an SSGN or just a SSG would have in being able to put land attack and strike missiles on a submersible platform and turn it in. I understand the torpedoes are a tough one because it's so hard. I almost think you have to do not torpedo tubes. Obviously, you have to do torpedoes, but even that's it's a terrible mix because, you know, torpedoes are designed for anti-warship. They're not really designed for, like, one of the biggest problems ever looked at is there's not enough torpedoes on submarines today to deal in anti-commerce. You don't have enough. Why would you waste a Mark 48 trying to sink a vessel? And I'm not 100% sure you're able to do it with a Mark 48 because of the size of some of these vessels today. You know, are you able to lift them up out of the water enough to create a big enough explosion to cause that sinking? So I was interested in that aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, what I've done is I've created two out of three tables. So the first table we've discussed is based purely around the anti-surface, anti-air warfare component of surface-based ships. The second table is based purely around carriers. And then the third table, which is the one that I still haven't quite drawn up yet, is the one that's based around submarines and anti-submarine capabilities. And yeah, in that, the Ohio SSGN is going to be a definite first rate. With the submarines, it's difficult because with everyone using VLS on modern ships, it's easy to go VLS cells and things like Harpoon box launchers. But with a submarine, you've got torpedo tubes, but you've got an awful lot more torpedoes and, as you say, stealth systems and everything backing that up. So one of the things I sort of looked at was, well, if you look at a Kilo versus a Seawolf, the Seawolf, has twice as many torpedo tubes as a Kilo. But if you go purely by launchers, that would suggest that 2 kilos has the same combat value as a Seawolf.
which is not a wise decision to be making, and unless you really like decorating the ocean floor with kilos, which I suppose is good for the Russian ship export industry because they need replacing. I'm more tempted to go with a weapons carried as opposed to launchers, which will make more of a difference because obviously something big like a Seawolf or a Virginia or an Astute is going to be carrying an awful lot more torpedoes and missiles than a kilo will. And then also including a small multiplier based on number of launchers and size of launchers. So if you say take the 21-inch torpedo tube as your standard, but then the Seawolf, for example, has these really big torpedo tubes, so that would get a multiplier for that, and it's got eight. So you basically have to come up with a standard number of tubes, standard number of standard size. So 21-inch, maybe 21-inch six tubes is your standard, and a submarine that's carrying less than that has less tubes.
Who's playing games? Who's doing this?
That wasn't me.
Who's giggling?
If you have a four tube sub, that's a negative. An eight tube sub is a positive, and then it's like a 600 millimeter torpedo tube versus 553. Positive, and if there's someone still out there wandering around with 18-inch tubes, then that's obviously a negative. But that the sub one is the most complex one, I think, which is why I haven't got around to fully calculating it yet. The carrier one, I think Steve's idea with going by sortie rate and range of aircraft, I'm definitely going to have to go over and revise my list because that is going to have a massive impact on where some of these air carriers sit. Although, just for interest at the moment, I used carriers only, so none of this, we have an LPD or an LHD that we happen to have aircraft on. The only exceptions I made were the Izumo, because let's face it, the Japanese designed those as carriers from the start. They just didn't want to tell anyone. And
They are through deck destroyers, man. You're not listening to them.
And I also included the America class in their lightning carrier configuration for America and Tripoli, just for reference. So in that respect, for carriers of the world, at the moment, the sole unrated ship, that's going to brig or the corvette, is the Cavour, the Italian one, which carries 16. Then at sixth rate, so your light frigate equivalent for carriers, you've got Vikram Aditya, the Indian Kiev conversion, the Izumos and the Americas. Then in fifth rate, you've got a very crowded category because you've got Kuznetsov, Queen Elizabeth in her normal cruising configuration, Liaoning, Shandong, and Charles de Gaulle. They're all fifth rates. So actually all of those carriers are that we've mentioned so far are not your frontline carriers, but effectively they're support carriers at best. Then fourth rate, I've currently got in the fourth rate a Type 003, although that is speculative on my part. I've given it a theoretical 60 strike aircraft and four AEW aircraft, and that was based largely on the fact that supposedly it's going to be around 85,000 tons. So I tried to draw a scale comparison with something like a Kitty Hawk, assuming it was carrying modern aircraft, but that's very theoretical. Then at the third rate, you've got the Nimitz-Ford class in their default air wing configuration that they roll around with these days. And also the Queen Elizabeth, if you pump it full of F-35s, it's theoretical maximum strike capacity. Then the Nimitz using its actual max capacity with a mixed air group becomes a second rate. And then if you just go stuff it, we're just putting FA-18s or F-35s on this thing, then a Nimitz or Ford goes all the way up to a first rate because it exceeds 100 and well, it goes up to that point to 130 aircraft. But yeah, I think it's got a certain amount of benefit because you can see where the Nimitz sits and where some of these smaller carriers sit. But it does also crowd the fifth rate category with all these non-Nimitz carriers. So I think factoring in the sortie rate and range was probably going to split those quite considerably, because like something like Kunetsov, for example, probably, let's be honest, probably doesn't even merit a fifth rate classification.
No, I mean, any of the carriers that ski jump launching a conventional jet is going to have no legs.
Yeah, so that's probably going to move the Chinese and the
Russians down. Because don't forget, they can't even launch a fully loaded aircraft to refuel the rest. Guys, I am restricted on time, so I'm going to have to sign out. But I'll just leave you with one thought which has struck me, which I think is enormously important, is to make sure that with the rating system goes way of convincing people that first rate does not equal good and sixth rate equals bad.
Yeah,
I think it's a very good point that a mixed fleet is enormously important, and that well handled, a fleet of third rates or even less can have an enormous strategic impact. Like, as you say, showing the flag, soft power, presence, persistence. So that's my lot. I will bid you farewell.
Thank you very much.
We are still here in a tough old lockdown, and we have to get out before we go start staring mad.
Good luck.
Okay, okay guys. Okay. Bye now.
See you later.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that's definitely something I'm going to have to include in my draft. I'm going to have to cite a bunch of. I did cite actually one thing which was quite amusing to me, which was the Constellation class these days under the classification that we come up with counts as a fifth rate 48 gunner, which in actual fact hilariously is exactly the same classification as the 1794 USS Constellation. Because it was also fifth rate 48 gunner.
You just referred to this as the Constellation system. It would be perfect.
There'll be no US politician who could argue against it.
No,
argue against the Constellation system.
I definitely think I'm going to have to throw in some references to various famous ships at the different rates to point out, as Steve pointed out, that just because it's a fifth rate doesn't mean it's awful, and just because it's a first rate doesn't mean it's the best thing since sliced bread.
I think we've sort of uncovered why they came up with the whole frigate, sloop, destroyer, cruiser, armored cruiser, battle cruiser, battleship classification system. But I think the problem is that one has just simply been around too long and has been abused too much.
Basically everyone was focused not on number of guns but size of guns. That's the thing. It worked while it was size of ship and size of guns was a very easy way to tell, okay, this is an 8-inch gun cruiser, that's a heavy cruiser. 6-inch gun cruiser, it's a light cruiser. It's smaller than a cruiser and it's got torpedoes, it's a destroyer. It's smaller than a cruiser, it's not got torpedoes, it's a sloop, or whatever you want to call your small ship. It's bigger than a cruiser, and it's got mahoosive guns. Okay, is it pocket heavily battleship. Armored or lightly armored? It's a battle cruiser or a battleship, depending on your perspective on that spectrum. It's got a flat top and aircraft takeoff on it. It's an aircraft carrier.
And before that, before you had the gun based system, as Sal pointed out, you had the first, second, and third class system. I think this is the problem. We're basically dealing with the vast majority of the world's combatants through the lens of a very narrow, maybe 20% of the ship classification system that existed 70 years ago. That's where there's not enough granularity in it, which is what this, whether we go with first, second, third class or first, second, third, fifth, sixth rates, it brings some of that back.
I think the abridged system of the treaties, that's what we're viewing it through. It's not even, if you consider what the number of cruisers and the types of cruisers which existed prior to the First World War, and then the First World War, it's not after the First World War, it's after the treaties, you suddenly get this going, oh, we have a light cruiser and a heavy cruiser. And you're going, well, that's kind of meh. And battle cruisers are now capital ships. Okay.
Well, and you still had the designation for vessels, too. I mean, first and second and third rates were ships of the line. You would have a fourth rate that could be a ship of the line or a frigate. I mean, that's where you get into that weapons classification also to it. But I think the point that Steve made is a really good one. You know, the sports analogy for me is like Moneyball. It's you don't need all the first class, you know, ships, you know, to do it. You need those third class. You need those fourth class, fifth class that are going to do third rate, fourth rate, fifth rate, they're going to do the hard work for you and, you know, move you around the bases, so to speak, and do all that hard work. But at the same time, you do need those heavy hitters down the road. And I think that's the argument you make with the rating system is, you know, the ships that are going to do the work, the ships that are going to be out there and the ships that did the work a lot of times were those lower rated vessels. They're the ones doing the presence missions. They're the ones doing it out there. But at the same time, you want your heavier rates standing by for the big battles. That's what you use them for. That's what you want them for. You know, and I think one of the problems, like, for example, in the U.S. Navy is we're sailing battle groups now much smaller than ever before. You know, you would send a Nimitz class carrier out with two Ticonderogas, four Berks. You know, now we're doing it with one Tyco, you know, maybe two Berks. And that really demonstrates the fact that they are much less capable in defense and strike than they were in the past. But it's hard to articulate that because, you know, all they see is the number of missiles and they say, well, that's a lot of missiles. That seems like a lot. But this system does demonstrate that.
You're basically saying, right, then we used to sell it with two first rates and four second rates. Now we're sailing with two second rates and one first rate. So it's the cumulative adding system. You know, it's the it's what are you adding your force together for? And right, okay, so what are we saying we need? Well, actually, you don't need to multiply that force up by having that many more second or first rates added on. But if you could add in a couple of constellations to take off some of the anti-submarine warfare duties of the Berks to allow them to concentrate on what they are good at, you suddenly have a far more capable force.
Right, and I think going with what Steve said, this is not a linear system, it's exponential. I mean, so, you know, as you go up a rate, I mean, you're not just increasing by number of cells, you're increasing by sensors, by capability, by reach, ability to deploy out further. You know, again, you know, if you have a 16-cell point defense system, you know, that's very limited range, or if you got, you know, a quad pack of harpoons that go as slow as a Model T, basically, today, versus hypersonics, you know, you start getting into those levels where... You know, is that the same? I mean, we're slapping harpoons back on ships, and tell you the truth, I'm not sure what that's going to do unless you have a hypersonic coming in behind it to distract them. You know, and that's what you use your harpoons for, basically, as decoys.
Yeah, I look, you know, it's again, I can't see how to emphasize, how to put across the concept of sustainability, because Drac was saying that for submarines. Count the total number of weapons as opposed to the launch tubes. VLS basically means the same thing as total number of weapons because they can't be reloaded. So I guess that is one consistency between the two. But then, you know, when you've got a carrier, which all of a sudden you can reload, then they become a whole order of magnitude more capable than your first rate non-flat top. So obviously that's why they're a carrier. That's why you spend the big bucks on buying a carrier and its support group. But
That raises the danger, Jamie, what you said of the logistics. You know, if you want to take out a U.S. Navy strike group or a British strike group, you don't go against the Nimitz, you don't go against the Queen Elizabeth, you go against the RFA supply vessel or the MSC supply vessel coming in. And if you can absorb 3 days of strikes, that's it. They're out of missiles, they're out of bombs, you know, and they got to go resupply somewhere else. And you know, that's the big element you have there. And I think that's a big asterisk when you put in for the rating system, because those vessels can resupply, resume, you know, as long as you can keep feeding a carrier, you're good to go. But I don't think people realize the greatest limitation on those carrier battle groups are the escorts and the escorts' ability to, if they're engaged in combat, to resupply their VLS systems, because the only way to do it now is to head back to port or have backups to replace them, which doesn't exist largely in most navies.
Yeah, I mean, just look at, obviously from my background with the armored carriers of the Royal Navy of Sakashima Gunto, it was 2.5 days was the operational time for the four fleet carriers of the Royal Navy, because their armored decks meant they had smaller magazines, basically. So less fuel for the fighters, less bombs for the bombers. And within 2.5 days, you know, which is roughly 5 sorties, I suppose, they were dry. So they had to turn around, head up further to sea, and reload with the fleet train. Now, of course, you could also resupply your escorts anti-aircraft ammunition back then. You can't now. So that whole cycle concept is outmoded. But I think it's something that is ingrained into people who read a lot of World War II history and think, well, why can't we do the same now? Well, we can't.
Yeah, and I think this is where you're probably going to have to see some very hard choices made at some point in the future, where you have things like, if you're taking your destroyers out to sea, how many of your big long-range surface-to-air missiles are you going to take? Because you will run out of those relatively quickly in a peer threat environment. But, and so do you go with, we're going to completely load out with Sea Viper or SM6 or whatever, and hope that we can absolutely pace the enemy using that, but we'll probably be out in a few days of combat? Or do we go 50-50 and load in quad pack CAM ER or quad pack ESSM, which massively multiplies the number of missiles you've got, but obviously an ESSM or a CAM ER is significantly less capable than an SM6 or a Sea Viper, and limit you've got more chances at shooting at the air enemy, but you've got less actual chance of intercepting with any given shot. But you might not run out of missiles quite as quickly.
I think that's going to be the big problem going on. I do think that is the one problem I have with the rating system really as a whole, is that I do worry that people are going to get obsessed with building a load of first-rate ships and going, we have to have hundreds of missile tubes on this because the Russians have hundreds of missile tubes. And you do realize that at some point, especially the Chinese, continuing their development as they are, the next generation of their ships will be cruisers. They keep calling them Type 55s destroyers, but let's be honest, they are first-rate and they're carrying a lot of missiles. If they, you have to think at some point, they're going to start building a bigger one, because every time they do keep building a bigger ship. And I do think the Chinese are one nation which has really studied Sergei Gorshkov and his perspective. That is, I see a lot of Chinese theorists and naval theorists coming in there, but I also see a lot of Gorshkov. And I think possibly that's because quite a lot of their modern naval theory is in many ways developed from the era when Gorshkov was being taught in their academy, and was a very big part of it. And I think he is... I see that, to an extent, leading to the development of, at some point, probably, and this might be just me thinking it, but I see this at some point developing, probably, I wouldn't be surprised if the next generation of Chinese surface ships have 144, 150 VLS cells. I wouldn't be surprised at that, because they're already talking about, they're already sort of thinking about 72 cell systems. If you stuck 2 72 cell units on a ship, you've got your 144, and you've suddenly got something which, yes, I know there are going to be people tend to be repeating the same thing. And this is what was said a lot about the Japanese. And, of course, we did the whole Section 22 thing, which kind of did iterate again. The Japanese weren't as technologically behind as the Americans like to say. In fact, they were peers or even superiors in some areas, in technological areas, than the Americans and the British. The fact is, you're going to sit there and there's someone who's going to say, oh, yes, but their 144 missiles aren't as good as ours. And you'll go, yes, but are they not good enough to the fact that we aren't carrying anywhere near that number? And the thing is, again, the whole point of the rating system is, yeah, no, that doesn't mean we need to start building our own ships with the same missile counts. But it means we do need to start thinking, hang on, if that's their equivalent, what is the point at which we have to start aiming? Do we have to start thinking seriously about pumping out third rates? And it's one of the interesting things that of Drak's table going through it is the number of nations which the third rates is does seem to be sort of the missing price point. In that, if you think about it, we've got fourth rates, we've got fifth rates. But Drak, how many examples were there of third rates you were talking in your table?
There were not that many. So third rates for the surface and anti-air combatants consists of the Yi Sun Shin Korean ships, the predecessors to the Sejong the Greats. There's only two of those. The Slava class Russian ships, which are getting a bit long in the tooth now. And in theory, if somebody pays for the 16 additional VLS cells, the Type 45s.
But I think what you're demonstrating right there, Alex and Drak, is number one, is the idea that the U.S. Navy's battling right now this idea of distributed lethality. They want to spread everything out. They want to get as many cells as they can across as many platforms as they can.
We know. We've heard about the San Antonio class.
Oh, I know.
We're about as rude about that as we are about the Belgians and their...
You deserve to be rude about it. You should be rude about it because it's the concept is great, but it always comes back to be bit by economy of scale. It's the money cost. It's how much does it take to do that? But if you use the analogy, if you use Trafalgar, for example, you have a couple of first rates led by a whole batch of third rates. And that's what you get to fight in these big battles. And that's kind of what you need now in some ways is a couple of these big, huge platforms that can do the sensors, that can do all those elements that you want to do, but surround them, again, maybe not with an OSV that's outfitted that can do 20 knots, but maybe with these third rates that can basically be the vessels that come up, have a point defense system. I mean, we talk about it in the U.S. all the time. Let's get a container ship and just pack it with missiles. Let's go to the arsenal ship. Let's do that. The problem is it gets too expensive then because, number one, you're putting all your missiles on one platform. It's very vulnerable. And then you have to put point defense on it, and then you're just making it a warship. You're just turning it back into a cruiser. And I think this is the selling point for third rates right here. It's that's what you need. You need a couple of first rates sprinkled in your forward, your van, your rear columns, surrounded by third rates, and that's the way you go in. We've maybe gone full circle here on levels of combat.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was just thinking that reminds me of the Battle of Trafalgar because the Royal Navy had five or six three deckers. They had a couple of first rates and a few seconds. A few of them were 98 gunners, but you look at where they positioned them. Three of them were positioned one after the other at the head of the column and under Nelson, and two more were at the head of the column, the other column with Royal Sovereign being one of them, because they were your big heavy hitters. They were the ones that punched through and broke the hole in the French and Spanish line, and then all the third rates piled in afterwards.
And don't forget HMS Africa.
Yes, just randomly doing its own thing.
Basically, don't forget Africa. You can never forget Africa in the Battle of Trafalgar.
I think USS Victory has a nice sound to it. I like the sound of it and everything. So yeah. You can't use it, so I mean it's already used, so we might as well go ahead and do it.
Well, we've got an HMS Enterprise, so it's only fair. But no, I think actually in that respect, the idea you mentioned earlier about
have an HMS President, but we'll leave that to one side.
the idea you mentioned about these kind of offboard autonomous platforms that are essentially just missile barges with a link to the actual ships. I think that actually does have a lot of merit because not only does that allow you to, as you say, effectively upgrade a ship that doesn't necessarily carry as many missiles in and of itself, they are to a certain extent expendable because you don't have to do all the additional bits about turning it into a warship because you expend those missiles first. So all your expensive sensors, your expensive and well-trained men, etc., they're all in your kind of core ship. And it's retaining its own onboard missiles to defend itself and the battle.
Maybe there's a use there for these surplus LCS hulls that can do 40 knots. So perhaps you could automate them somehow.
Level the superstructure, just fill them with Mark 41s and just have them tearing back and forth as missiles.
Yeah, so they can reload, yeah.
Just to be clear, only half of them can do 40 knots. The other half are kind of slow, about 16 knots right now.
Because they keep
replacing their combining gears.
Yeah, they eat their own gear systems. But yeah, in all seriousness, basically a fast hull that holds missiles.
The Trimaran half, which can do it? So you could theoretically put a lot more missiles off them.
Well, I mean, they have large flat flight deck areas with the mission bay right below each of them. The U.S. Navy's getting ready to decommission the first four LCSs. I mean, I don't see why not take two of them and experiment with them and rip them apart and do that. I mean, you can do that. I mean, the issue is weight. It's always going to be weight with those vessels because they're so lightweight, you can't put
and
that much
galvanic action because, you know, this was a really new concept that the American Navy seemed to have had trouble with when ordering them.
It's a new concept to the U.S. Navy. It's not a new concept to anybody else. Let's be clear about that. Everybody in the world. I've got a boat outside right now that's got a big zinc block on it for that specific reason. So I don't think it's a surprise to anybody else but the U.S. Navy.
Well, yeah. maybe don't blame the Navy. Just blame the procurement office.
That's true. But you're right. The PEO.
There is a theory they should be connected to the Navy as they're procuring for the Navy.
Well, hang on. Now we're getting into the fleet air arm and the aircraft realms. So, stones are glass houses, you know.
I do think though the idea of the offboard weapons platform. There's a lot of other things that make it attractive apart from anything else. It's just more things for an enemy missile to lock onto, because let's face it, if someone blows up a 4,000-ton canoe, effectively, that's just full of missiles, yeah, that'll hurt a bit, assuming you haven't launched a bunch of them already, but it's not going to hurt you nearly as much as those same missiles totaling a Burke. But also, it actually improves, even if you stick with VLS, which is probably easier for those kinds of things, rather than swing arms, but it actually improves your rate of fire as well. Because you could your missile farm, your block of VLS cells, you can fire. I think it's normally supposed to be one missile per second, but you can't really fire much more than that because otherwise you'll be firing missiles into the exhaust of the previous missile, which doesn't end well. But if you've got a Burke or a Constellation or a Zumwalt or whatever, and it's sailing around with two or three of these little offboard weapons platforms, you even if you don't ever fire the missiles on your own ship because you're retaining them for when you don't have these platforms available. If you've got three or four of these things, you could be firing one missile for one missile off from each of them. So actually you've now got eight missiles per second going off from the same sensor platform as opposed to just one or two, which increases the number of missiles you can get into the sky. And nowadays, as opposed to before, when like you said, with the older ships that could only guide four at once, but nowadays with modern Aegis systems and such, they can handle a lot more missiles in flight.
Well, and you add satellites into it too, your ability to control them via satellite, and plus you're launching from a much larger area, not from one pinpoint on the ocean, you're from multiple points in the area. You're also assuming that, you know, in the first island, second island chain, there's going to be other vessels out there. It's not a flat environment. There's going to be, these vessels will be able to, you know, kind of meld in with other vessels out there and be out there, because it's not going to be just you know, two sides fighting off. There's going to be a lot of vessels occupying that space, and it'll be very hard for an enemy to identify these vessels if they're blended in correctly. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at. Again, we get into this distributed lethality argument with the Navy, and all they see is you know, putting missiles on every platform that's afloat, and that's not exactly, you know, again, you don't want to put a San Antonio in the middle of the combat. You just don't. You just don't want her there.
You really don't. Yeah. We do.
No.
If there is one thing anyone takes away from this podcast, there is something we'd like to emphasize. You do not put a San Antonio class in the middle of a combat zone.
One of the points I've tried to explain to a lot of people, which some people really don't seem to get, is that there's a difference between a juicy target and a priority target. A San Antonio full of troops is a juicy target because, yeah, if you blow up, you've blown up a load of troops. This is, if you're the enemy of the U.S. Navy, that's a good thing for you. But if you're out in an open ocean engagement
a San Antonio is probably down the bottom of your list of priority targets, because in its current configuration, the San Antonio can't harm you. The Burks can harm you. The Tycos can harm you. The carrier can definitely harm you. So you're going to be firing at them first. You're never going to find any commander of a surface action group or an air wing or a submarine who's going to be looking at a full US counter invasion force sailing for Taiwan or something like that and go, yeah, you know what? There's a Ford there. There's a Nimitz over there. There's three Tycos over there. There's a Burke there. I know. I'll shoot at the San Antonio. That'll go well. Because then you're just going to get murdered by the return fire immediately. You're going to engage the targets that can hurt you first.
I do know one commander who might have done that, BT.
Yes.
But let's be honest, yeah, that's what he did.
Can we clone him and supply him to the Chinese? That would solve an awful lot of problems. in all seriousness, it's like at the minute the San Antonio now possesses weapons which can hurt you, it moves up the priority list.
I'm not sure harpoons can hurt them though.
Well, they might stick El Razum on it or something like that or, yeah. Or whatever.
If they quad packed ESSM, and I would believe they were just going to quad pack ESSM, I can sort of see their viability, and I would support that for the San Antonios. Myself, for the San Antonios, I'd be thinking more like, I don't know, 57mm or 40mm and setting up a flak wall around them, because.
Well, it's a defensive weapon.
They need a defensive weapon system.
Yeah, but that's the thing. As a defensive weapon system, it doesn't move them up the priority list, because an ESSM isn't going to hurt something that's launching granites from 400 miles away, whereas an LRASM launcher system will. So the San Antonio only moves from juicy target to priority target when it's actually close enough to something to actually deploy its troops. Why you'd make something that's full of several thousand vulnerable troops who can't really do much to defend themselves in the middle of the open ocean, why you'd move it up into as a priority target there, I have no idea.
Yes, well, I think we've pretty much, once again, gone around circles. The reason why they're doing it is because they need missiles at call.
Exactly.
Because... the ability to operate at a sustained level,
because they built the Zumwalts around the gun system, which honestly, if they'd said the guns isn't going to work and said turn them into, I don't know, a viable cruiser design with maybe a 5-inch gun, but more like I would hope more a 5-inch and a double 57mm forward, add in some more missiles, another couple of double 57mm, one on either side on the wings, and another double 57mm over the hangar, then that would have been a fairly decent, fairly lethal cruiser.
So, Sal, should we be stripping out our VLS systems and putting in the rail guns?
I wouldn't put the rail guns in until you have a rail gun that's working. Now, the swing arms, that's something we could talk about, because I do think, you know, again, I go back to the submarine analogy. You know, why do submarines still have torpedo tubes and not all packed with VLS, you know, and torpedoes and VLS, for example, or side launch? You know, why do we have those magazines? Basically, we're still using basic launchers, torpedo tubes in submarines vice all VLS, because it gives you an ability to switch up weapons. It gives you ability to reload. It allows you to keep your submarines forward deployed. You know, we will, you know, change out loads quickly. You know, it's not talked about very much, but you'll see subs come in and swap out loads all the time based on what the mission's going to be and what they need to do. They need mines, they need torpedoes, they need tomahawks. What do they need to go out there? And you see that being done all the time, because it's much easier to do that than to swap out a VLS in some ways. And so, you know, I think that's an interesting discussion back. I think, again, going back to the magazine and the swing arms is another aspect. If you're going to replenish at sea, you know, because, again, it's just physically impossible to do a VLS at sea. It really is, because of the tight margins in that cell to get it to have this huge, massive cell standing upright above you. You can't have any motion whatsoever. You can't. I mean, they experimented with trying to do this by helicopter, and that was an utter disaster when they tried to do that. I mean, it's just, you know, watch any rescue swimmer go into water and they just pendulate everywhere and just magnify it by weight for a VLS cell. There's just no way to do it unless you're in a magazine. Unless you're in a magazine and you can, you know, get into that VLS cell, that's about the only way you're going to be able to do it. But as navies try to get more and more cells at sea, there's got to be a way to articulate how you can get more cells at sea and exponentially increase what cells you have. Because I do think, you know, the argument we were talking about earlier, a first class and several third classes, I think you could do that with a third class and several fifth classes too. You magnify that, you know, what that third class now become, or third rate becomes by being able to link it together and demonstrate that they can go to another level up. They can fight above their rating class by doing that, and their ability to spread out. And again, I go back to that Moneyball analogy. You know, you don't need all the first rates to be a good Navy. What you need to be able to do is deploy. And I think that goes back to what Steve was talking about with sensors and a lot of this other element that goes into it. The rating system works great as a quick eyeball, you know, hey, we can make a chart. We can measure the size of navies real quickly. But, you know, when you start getting into it, and even the rating system back in the time of Napoleon was complicated because it didn't fairly articulate what the ships were, you know, because, you know, a constitution.
What it does do, though, is it provides a scaffolding, it provides a gateway for those who don't know to enter the discussion. It gives them that framework at which to enter that discussion. And I think, you know, there's never going to be a perfect system in terms of granular comparison. Mm. But if you can at least provide a reasonable at a glance categorization, then you're halfway there. And the other half, no matter what the subject is, no matter whether it's aircraft, tanks, ships, racing cars, football players, you're always going to have the asterisk alongside of every name that explains why this particular individual is an individual.
Right. So. And I think it also highlights real quick the concept, because we're using that outdated naming system that comes from World War II. You know, a frigate can sink, you know, a frigate can never sink a battleship in World War II. It's just not going to happen. It's just, there's always that one kind of, you know, weird analogy where it could. But, you know, conceivably, a sixth rate could sink a first rate without a problem.
No one ever told the tribal class destroyers they couldn't try and
sink
battleships.
I knew you were going to come back
with
that. I just knew I was going to get that.
Several occasions, they gave it a jolly good go.
but I mean, you do have a potential where a sixth rate, you know, missile carrying ship can sink a first rate, you know, if it is. And I think that's one of the things that why the old system of corvette, frigate, destroyer, and cruiser doesn't work anymore.
There were times in Age of Sail where I think there's one where a fourth rate did make a first rate actually surrender, because it managed to do the old thing of Machi, managed to get in a position where it was firing straight from the stern into the ship, along the ship, and able to rake it, and basically wiped out half the crew in a couple of salvos. And you sit there and go, well, that shouldn't in theory happen. But it can happen, and that's a thing you can understand in the rating system. Whereas if you turned around to most people today and went, but that frigate will beat that destroyer, the everyone would go, why? What? How's that? And we'd sort of go, well, actually, because honestly, that frigate is a well and truly a fourth rate, and that destroyer that you're calling a destroyer is technically a sixth rate, if we're being very generous.
I do like the idea of raising, literally razzing some of the retired LCS and turning them into missile boats, just missile tubs.
The return of the razzé.
Yeah.
Now at 2 hours, I suppose it's getting to the point where we should wrap it up. Yeah. Any
Jamie
final thoughts?
Probably need some sleep.
Yeah, that's it.
I gotta go to work, so I understand that.
All right. Any final thoughts? Have we achieved anything today?
Well, I've definitely got a few bits and pieces. I need to make some modifications and additions to this this paper. So thank you very much in spirit to poor old Steve, who's gone off somewhere else, and thank you once again for gracing us with your presence, Sal.
I did. It's always a pleasure to join you, gentlemen. It's always good to have someone on the broadcast who speaks the Queen's English correctly.
At some point, I've got to. I still need to arrange with you at some point to sort out a interview style recording on naval logistics. So I will do that at some point.
You need to do that.
Yeah.
You need to do that. And we need to do probably something about logistics for the long war at some point. But no, we have been kind of sidetracked from the long war this year into the rating debate. And I have to think...
They are related. They are related.
They are related.
You just constantly bring it back to that point. The whole reason why this started out was, how could you measure a ship's capability to fight a long war? Yeah. And a long war, not necessarily in the terms of years, but in the terms of days.
Well, that was the scary thing. When you started realizing, and this all comes back to the point when I realized that under the definitions of a long war, which were being employed and which are still to an extent being implied today, anything over 4 days is a long war. So the Falklands War, a long war. Quite a lot of the stuff that, you know, we're talking about, Afghanistan and Iraq were frankly, I'm not sure if they even qualify as a long war. They qualify as a, I don't know, a millennial generational fight by by those things. They're not a long war. They're beyond the long war. And you start to go, well, hang on. Why haven't navies been planning for this? And this, you sit there and go, because the assumption was that the war would, that a Cold War would go nuclear within 4 days. And you sit there and go, okay, but what happens if it didn't? Well, that's the question. And then you go, well, you start to think of, well, all the conventional wars we fought have gone on longer than 4 days. The first Gulf War went on longer than 4 days. All these things are on longer.
Well, we have a chief of naval operations who was the quote. I don't have the quote in front of me, but basically he mentioned the fact that, you know, we just don't plan for fighting a long war, and we haven't really thought about this in terms of logistics. And unfortunately, that's all too true. It's a shocking statement by the head of our Navy to admit that they haven't really planned on this, you know, beyond just the first few days. Because again, any sort of peer-to-peer conflict is not going to be over in 3 to 4 days. It's going to be that long war. And I think, Jamie, you know, keep hopping on that, because I think that's the fundamental issue that is driving everybody. Everybody thinks it's going to be a short war and the logistics is going to be right there close by. We won't have to do the long haul across the Pacific or the Atlantic. And that's just not the case.
I just think that the way that international politics are being played at the moment is very much that sort of salami slicing brinkmanship process, which is a long drawn out process. And I think that level of escalation, you know, is likely to continue up the chain further. So the prospects of having some sort of long standoff is likely.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. Thank you very much. Right. I suppose the next subject matter will be one that was raised rather interestingly by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Was how so many Chinese Coast Guard and warships are built with strengthened hulls designed to make them survivable in a ramming scenario. So,
yeah.
I thought you were going to say strengthened deck guns.
No, so deck guns. The COD wars all over again, but this time with, you know, a very lightly hulled Western ships versus... versus the ram bow that we were joking about so much previously.
Interestingly enough, most of the recent papers I've seen about the COD wars, they either come from one PhD student at King's College London who has been really doing a lot of work on it and is doing a PhD all sort of around that period. And the others have all come out of China.
We're going to come up with a rating system now with triremes, biremes now, and rams. So
you forgot quadrimarines, quinquamarines.
Exactly.
There are so many we can go to.
Here comes the second rating system now.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.